All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. Welcome to our program today. I'm really excited to have you here. We've got so many things going on. We've got two great guests that are going to be talking about their experiences in Vietnam. One is a doctor with a MASH unit over there, and one was actually a casualty that was treated by the same doctor. So got to stick around for that story. I think it's really great. The other things that are going on is that I wanted to introduce you to a new friend of ours here on Veterans Radio. And her name is Suzette Dexter. And Suzette is a Marine. She served from 1983 to 1987. She's been to all the hot spots for Marines, Parris Island, 29 Palms, Camp Pendleton, Okinawa, the Philippines. She got out of the service as a Lance Corporal. And we've recently started talking about some ideas for programming that maybe we can do. So, Suzette, say hello to the Veterans Radio audience.
Hello, everybody.
So, reason I wanted to bring Suzette on today was to just kind of give her an idea of how a program hopefully works smoothly. And the other thing was to talk just briefly about a program that she brought to me that we're going to try and put together ourselves later on this spring. So, Suzette, can you talk a little bit about the idea that you came to me with?
Diane Carlson Evans. We're going to talk about her later on this spring. She was a nurse during Vietnam, and she went through a lot after Vietnam, after the war, when she went to the wall, and she saw the wall presented in Washington, D.C., and she wanted to know why there wasn't anything for nurses, because the nurses saved those lives of American veterans, American military servicemen and women. And, well, she fought for a very long time, and we want to go into her trials and tribulations of everything that she went through and the fight to get noticed. And she wanted it right by the Vietnam Wall, and she finally won that internal war of hers. And we'd like to expand on that further with her this spring.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. We've had some other nurses on that have talked about that program and the monument itself and the battle they had to go through to get that thing constructed. So, to our audience, everybody out there, kind of stick around. And in the next couple of weeks, Suzette will be back with her story, and we'll see how we can pull that together. So thanks, Suzette.
Thank you, Dale.
Okay. Before we get into the program, I got to make sure that we thank our sponsors, because without our sponsors, we can't ever do this program. So let's start off with our longest sponsor. By the way, folks, did you know that we've been doing this now for 20 years? 20. That was my call sign, Skychief 20. There's an interesting fact for you, right? So anyway, let's get into this. So Legal Help for Veterans, they specialize in veterans' disability claims. Give them a call at 800-693-4800 or go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for the certification of veteran-owned businesses. If you want to do business with the federal government or with many corporations and you are a veteran-owned business, you need to get certified and kind of prove that you are, because there have been some people out there that said they were veteran-owned and really weren't. So contact NVBDC at 888-237-8433, or you can go to their website. That's nvbdc.org. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information about the medical center here, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We also want to make sure we thank our local veteran service organizations for their longtime support for us, the Irwin Prescott American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor. And, of course, we all want to thank all of you out there who have, through your donations, have helped us stay on the air for these 20 years. And we're going to do everything we can to keep our mission going for another 20, if at all possible. So let's get right into our program now. Joining me on the line right now, first off, is Dr. Ruel Long. MD. He was a MASH doctor in Vietnam, and his book is entitled MASH Doctor in Vietnam, A Memoir of the War and After. Burrell, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you on here. I'm really excited to talk to you today about this. And I guess I'm going to bring on Jim as well. So the patient in this case is Jim Dayline. I might be mispronouncing that name. But, Jim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Dale. Pleasure to be with you.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
No. It's mispronounced all the time.
So how do I get it right?
Dylan.
Dylan? Okay. Got it. Jim Dylan. So, all right, Jim, I'm going to ask you to hold on for a bit while I talk with Ruel for a moment.
Alrighty.
Okay. So, Ruel, tell me, why did you finally sit down and write this story?
Well, I kept a diary the whole, just about the entire time from the time I hit basic training through most of the Vietnam tour. And I had like most people, I bought a good 35 millimeter camera while I was there. I had a lot of photographs and I pretty well documented most of my experiences over there. And I thought about maybe someday I might write about it, but it was the Jim's contact that started it all for me. And I had already retired, and I'd gone with a veterans group over to Pioneer High School to talk to the kids about our experiences in Vietnam. And I told them about this guy that I had taken care of during my first month in Vietnam. And he was only a couple years older than they were, and he had graduated from Flushing High School. And I told him about how we took care of him, about what had happened to him. He was an athlete in high school and had lost his legs over there. And we talked about it, and I got home and got to thinking about that and wondered what happened to him. And I dug my diary out, and I had the whole description of that day in there. Didn't have his name. Couldn't think of it to save my life. And I spent a few weeks going with the internet, trying to find information on anybody who graduated from Flushing High School, who was a veteran and from Vietnam. And I looked for weeks and I couldn't find anything. And then I'd given up, and I was out mowing the grass out back on the farm. I retired, of course. This was in 2014. And my wife came to get me, and she said, "You know, you need to come into the house and listen to a message on the phone." And I said, "Who is it?" And she says, "Somebody you took care of in Vietnam." And I said, "Somebody you took care of in 1970. I said, "I was in Vietnam then." She says, "I know." So I came in and I turned on the record. I punched in the numbers and to listen to the message. And the voice on the other end said, "If this is the Dr. Long of the famous 27th MASH," he says, "you took care of me back in 1970. This is a stab from the past." He used that phrase. "You took care of me back in 1970, and I just wanted to make contact with you." And he left his phone number. I knew exactly who it was. And I had to call him back. We had a long conversation. And my dad passed away a few weeks after that, and I was tied up with that for a while. But the next year, in the fall of 2015, we had our reunion at the Dexter Bakery in Dexter, Michigan. And we had a long visit about what each of us had done. And it was an emotional time.
I can only imagine what that was like.
Yeah. At the end of that meeting, as he was going for his medical appointments, he said, "I had to find you again because I didn't get a chance to thank you for your part in saving my life." Well, that started, I got it all out again. And that's what precipitated me writing the book. It took me 6 years. Jim will admit it, I think. It took me about 6 years to extract his life story out of him, and it's a wonderful story. And I had to have it all before I wrote it. It was people need to know what casualties who survive and go home with the kind of injuries he had, what they go through. They need to read about that. And what they have to overcome. And Jim overcame a lot, and he's got a remarkable story, and I wanted people to know it.
Well, we're going to get to Jim's story in just a minute. I guess I should, I'll go that way. This is kind of a free-flowing conversation. Jim, what motivated you to give Dr. Long a call?
Well, Rule helped me do a tape to send home that he couldn't discuss my condition with my parents or anybody, my family. But he got permission in order for me to record a cassette tape and send that home. And I am a guy that saves things. Can't always find them, but I ran across that tape with Rule's information, and I decided to give him a call and see if we couldn't reconnect.
Those calls are awesome. Let's just put it that way. I've only had one like that, but it was somebody I hadn't heard from in 40 years, 50 years, something like that. It had to bring some great memories back, great memories and some tragic moments, obviously, for both of you. Rule, I wanted to kind of go back to Flint, where you grew up, and talk a little bit about how did you get involved in the Army in the first place?
Okay, sure. I was I graduated from the University of Michigan Medical School in 1968. The Tet Offensive occurred in January of that year. And with three other classmates, we signed on to do our internships up in Flint. My family lived up there. And we signed on to do them at McLaren General Hospital. And at that same time, Jim was graduating high school over there in Flushing, Michigan, just 7 miles west of us. And anyway, we went up there. And I did my rotating internship there with, and rotations through internal medicine, surgery, labor, and delivery in the emergency room. And I even did a rotation over in Flushing, Michigan with a very busy general practitioner. Never ran into Jim then, but or his family, but I was over there for quite a bit. And then at the end of 5 months into that internship, I got the typical letter from the Army letting me know that I was an obligated volunteer and that I was now a member of the Army Reserves. And with the rank of first lieutenant. Well, I knew that eventually I'd be getting a call to active duty, just didn't know when, and I had not signed up for any kind of deferment to do any residency training at that point, and wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And so I they called it a Berry plan type thing. I wasn't involved in that, so I knew they were probably going to nail me right after internship. And so I figured I might as well get good use of my time, and I signed up for the emergency room. I worked the emergency room up at Gaylord, Michigan for the month of July of 69 after the internship. Went up there. I was supposed to work 24 on, 24 off. The other guy didn't show up, and I had to move into the hospital and work 30 straight days and catch naps when I could. Then I came back to Flint and still hadn't gotten a letter to active duty. And so I signed up to work the two emergency rooms in Flint at McLaren and St. Joe. Back then, it wasn't considered a medical specialty, there was a big group, I think 80 doctors, primary care doctors, who had signed up to cover shifts, leave their office and cover a shift here and there. Most of them, a lot of them didn't want to. They'd rather be in their office. So when they found out I was available, they would give me their shifts. And so I could work full-time between the two ERs and get a lot of trauma experience. And matter of fact, I signed up for too many shifts. On New Year's Eve of 1969, I ended up working the day shift at McLaren, the evening shift at St. Joe, and the midnight shift back at McLaren with an ambulance crew providing my transportation between the hospitals. And it was a very eventful 24 hours. I saw a bit of everything with the alcohol consumption around that time and all the car accidents. I had a lot to do. But I was able to sharpen my skills during those 11 months and had I ended up doing a lot of things at that young age, taking care of people with a pneumothorax. I trached the guy as soon as he got to St. Joe when there was no way to establish an airway on him, with an endotracheal tube, and I had to trach him myself. And so there was a lot of things that went on during that year that, prepared me somewhat for what I would see doing triage in Vietnam. Not everything. You couldn't duplicate what you saw in Vietnam, but I did get some skills. And then, May the 4th rolled around with all the anti-war sentiment in the country, and then the Kent State shootings took place. The four students killed at Kent State and one paralyzed. And everything sort of mushroomed after that. And within 2 weeks, I got my fourth child was born, and I got a letter from the Army letting me know I was going to have to report for active duty down at Fort Sam Houston on July the 6th. That was the basic course for doctors, and after that, my orders took me to Vietnam. It was down there that I ended up signing up for some anesthesia training. So
I wanted to interrupt you just for a second here, because your journey through medical school, and this is all in the book. The book is entitled "Mash Doctor in Vietnam," and the author is Roel Long. And it's you did a whole bunch of things even before you got to medical school. This is what was interesting to me. Is I've written these down. So hold on. First of all, you got a teaching certificate.
Right.
So you
did my practice teaching at Flint Central High School. Yes.
All right. Then you worked at the Chevrolet plant in Flint. You worked at the police department. In addition to the emergency room, but you had four kids. I didn't realize this is the educational part of this, folks. I didn't realize that somebody with a family of four children could end up getting drafted. You can't see my fingers in quotes.
If I'd had the good sense not to go to medical school, I would have never been drafted, because back then, if you were married with kids, you didn't have to go. But once you finish medical school, Selective Service puts you in a different category, and they let you know now that, you know, none of the other rules apply, okay? And so the term the Army used in all the letters is obligated volunteer. You know, they let you know you just volunteered, okay? I never saw the word draft anywhere on any papers, okay? It was just obligated volunteer.
Obligated volunteer. All right. So you ended up going down to Brooke Army Hospital, right, in Texas, for your indoctrination.
Yeah. While I was down there, it was the basic course down there. You know, they put us through some of the crawling under live fire and getting familiarized with the M14, doing the map course and things like that out at Camp Bullis. But basically, there were a lot of lecture series on the different things we needed to know about diseases we might encounter, snakes we might have to treat, and how to treat war injuries and stuff. There was, you know, all of that. But while I was there, there was a big auditorium with a few hundred of us there, and there was a lot of anti-war sentiment there, too. And Colonel Mendenhall came in one day, and he said, I just want to address the doctors that have orders for Vietnam, general medical officers that have orders for Vietnam. I'd like to interest some of you in an extra 4 months of training in anesthesia before you go over. You're still going to have to go, but if you're interested, come and see me over at Brooke. And I went over and talked to him. And it sounded pretty good. It sounded like something I might enjoy. And he sent me up to the Military Academy at West Point, at beautiful campus on the Hudson, that historic place. And I got to go up there for 4 months at that little hospital. They got a nice big hospital now, but it was just a little two operating room thing in the heart of the campus. And there was one anesthesiologist there and one nurse anesthetist, and that anesthesiologist who had trained up Minnesota. His job was to teach me anesthesia as much as he could in 4 months before I was to go to Vietnam. And it was a wonderful experience.
I couldn't believe that you got sent to West Point. I only wish I'd gotten sent to West Point.
Well, I tell you, the funny thing is up there, I learned right away whenever I went out of the hospital on that campus, I just kept my hand right up to my forehead. I was told I was going to have to do that, or I was going to wear out my right arm, because the cadets would salute everything that moved. Everything that moved there, you couldn't go anywhere out there without just keeping your right hand right up to your forehead, because they'd wear you out. They saluted everything, your car, everything. So that I found out right away.
Well, that was interesting. Unfortunately, well, it's a nice little interlude before you got to go to the to Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, we got to go back. The family got to be there with me for that. It was nice. They put us out at Stewart Field in some empty housing out there. And what was called camping out. They gave us cots and blankets and utensils, but we didn't care. We got to all be together anyway. And then after that 4 months, we went back home to get settled in before I had to step on that airplane at Bishop Airport for Vietnam.
Okay, so you went over to Vietnam in November of 1970?
No, I went over December the 1st. That was a rough day when we all went over to Bishop Airport. It was a small airport back then, just one place to go in and out, and a portable ramp going up to the plane. And I was there with my wife and four kids. My parents, my two brothers, and my sister saw me off that day. And I flew on December 1st, flew out to Oakland, got bussed over to Travis, just sat in the terminal all night, and then caught a plane. It was Seaboard World Airways is what it was called. It was a freight hauler back then, but they had converted to haul troops. And I took that up to Alaska. We deplaned briefly there, and when we took off, I was thankful I had not been 3 or 4 days earlier, because the pilot pointed out as we took off headed for Japan, the people on the left side of the plane could look down and see the crash of the of the DC-8 that had crashed in an aborted takeoff on the 27th of November, just a few days earlier. We could see that wreckage. They lost about 45 troops, Army and Air Force troops that day. They had like 229, I think, on board. Most of them survived. A lot of bad burns, but most of them did survive. But the people on the left side of the plane could look down and see all of that rubble still on the field down there. And fortunately, I was on the right side of the plane. I didn't care to look at it. The trip down for basic training was my first experience on a commercial airline, and I wasn't that easy about all this anyway. And so I didn't even care to look at it. So I just sat back and watched the ocean for an awful long time before we got into Tokyo in a driving rainstorm. So,
yeah, that's a long. That was a long flight.
When you take a flight like that, you appreciate how much of the planet is water. You know, looking down and wondering what if we had some kind of emergency, where do we go? You know, where's the emergency landing spot? way out here in the middle of all this water. You know, so it was a long haul, and then driving rainstorm for the landing, and then from there off to Benoit and. Landing in Benoit was funny because as we're getting off the plane, it's night and they got floodlights on the plane. And as we're deplaning, here's this long line of ragged looking troops in jungle gear, just jeering with a lot of profanity because they're waiting to board the same plane to go home because their tours were over. But they were letting us know what suckers we were. And a lot of bad language and stuff, but that was quite a night.
They certainly do try to get you off. They want you off that plane as fast as possible.
Oh, they did, and they were pretty rugged looking, pretty ragged.
So, I'm sure. Your thoughts go through your mind. You're going, oh my God, am I going to look like that in a year?
You wonder, and then that bus ride from Benoit to Long Bend. They had a Vietnamese guy driving that bus he drove it like, the one time I was in Tokyo after a medevac flight, those people over there don't know how to drive anything. And this guy, he drove it like a taxi driver in Tokyo. He was a pretty reckless guy, but he got us there.
That was one of the more frightening experiences I think many of us had, was just the ride from the airport to the 90th replacement. All right. So once you get to the 90th replacement, you got sent up north. Where did you end up in Vietnam?
Well, what happened? I was only in Long Bend about 12 days getting some airways. I did some cases at the 24th Evac there and got some air with the equipment. And after about 12 days, some major sat me down with another guy who had taken the course somewhere else. And he looks at us and he says, well, one of you has to go north and one has to go south. Well, this other guy says, I'll go south. And so he looks at the major looks at me and he says, well, I guess you'll be going north. So I said, okay. So they cut their orders and I look at them and they're sending me to Chu Lai, to the 27th Mobile Army Surgical Hospital at Chu Lai. And that's where on the 13th, I flew up there and checked in with Colonel Gear, who's the commanding officer there. And, I was there about 10 days, done quite a few cases, got familiarized with standard procedure in the triage because I was going to be working triage and anesthesia. And it was about 10 days before Jim was flown in.
Okay, this is a good time to switch over to Jim just a little bit. So, Jim, how did you end up in Vietnam? What's your story? Were you drafted or did you enlist?
I enlisted. I went... Well, I'd been out of high school for a while. I was working at the truck plant in Flint, and I knew my number was going to come up in the draft, so I decided I was going to beat that and join. I felt that number one, it was my duty, and number two, I looked at the GI benefit, the GI Bill, as a benefit that would help me out considerably, and it has. So I joined and went to basic at Fort Knox. I stayed right there for advanced individualized training. I was in the armor. I was an armor crewman there. And then I went to Fort Benning, Georgia, to infantry OCS officer candidate school. Okay. And upon graduation, they sent me back to Fort Knox because I... I did a branch transfer from infantry to armor. Since I had previous experience there, the powers that be felt that I could serve in that capacity, so I was sent to Fort Knox and went to armor officer orientation, and I was stationed there in the 5th of the 33rd Armor. We supported the armor school and did a lot of training with the M60 tanks.
Okay. All right. So then you ended up going to Vietnam at the, you got there in November, if I understand, right?
Yes, I did. I got there in November, and same circuit. Well, I took the scenic route when we left Travis Air Force Base, went to Hawaii for refueling, and then to Guam, then to Okinawa, and then finally into Benoit to the 90th Repo Depot. So
right. Yeah, that's the way I got there, by way of Hawaii.
Yeah, well, you know, I can always say I've been to Hawaii for 2 hours.
And some of the other places for only 2 hours, too. So when you were in armor, this is always a big learning experience to me, folks, even though I was, you know, in the service myself 100 years ago, it seems like now. But what were your duties when you got to Vietnam? You were up in II Corps as well, correct?
Oh, I Corps,
okay.
Yep. I was the first of the first cab I was assigned to, and we had M113 personnel carriers, armored personnel carriers, with a couple of Sheridan tanks in our platoon. I was a platoon leader, and our job was to patrol our area of operation. We'd go and set up a defensive position in the field, and then we would do foot patrols to make sure that there weren't any bad guys about.
Well, let's tell them a little bit about your run into the bad guys and how you ended up meeting Rule.
We had been on a patrol. We'd beaten the bush, as we used to say. And came back. I also, there was a sniper team from my platoon that was deployed, and they came under attack. So we mounted up two of our APCs and went to support them and called in the gunships, called in, they had a blue team with them. The blue team are two squads of infantry that come in after the Cobra gunships come through and do their gun runs. And we met up with their blue teams, and we started to push through in order to relieve our sniper team. We had three men in a position that they were in a bad way. They were brought under fire, and we were there to relieve them, and we did. We were able to get them out of that bad situation. In the process, we also captured a couple NVA regulars, and the intelligence group, they wanted those guys back for interrogation, so we started to pull back and head back to the helicopters, and that's when I hit the booby trap that took my legs, and they were able to get me on one of those helicopters pretty quickly and got me into, we had an aid station at our fire base. Our fire base was north of Chulai, and they got me in there, got me stabilized, and then got another helicopter trip down to the 27th Surgical, where I met Rule.
Okay, we're gonna take a break right here. So, Jim has stepped on a booby trap. Unfortunately, lost both of his legs in this incident, and now back at the 27th MASH unit, and meets up with his new best friend. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Staff Sergeant Drew Dix was working on a CIA project near Cambodia when the Tet Offensive began. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Dix's mission was to coordinate intelligence gathering with a unit made up mainly of indigenous Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Chinese Hmongs. In late January, Dix and his men were operating with part of a SEAL platoon to get information about a rumored Viet Cong offensive. On January 31st, Dix's unit returned to base to find the Tet Offensive had begun and the city had been overrun. When they tried to land, they encountered heavy fire. One SEAL was killed, the others pulled out, leaving Dix with only a handful of indigenous soldiers. He moved through the city, picking up pockets of friendly soldiers. His first mission was to rescue an American nurse. Then he brought several CIA employees to safety. Dix and his men moved through the city in an effort to liberate it. He assaulted a building alone in the face of heavy fire to rescue two Filipinos. He killed six Viet Cong and brought out the men. Dix and his men fought through the night, taking back the hotel, theater, embassy house, and other buildings. On February 2nd, after 56 hours of battle, the city was freed. Dix's men had killed an estimated 200 VC. He was presented the Medal of Honor by President Johnson on January 16th, 1969.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
We're back here on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with Ruel Long, who's was a doctor in Vietnam, an anesthesiologist, actually, and has got a relatively new book out called MASH, Doctor in Vietnam, Memoir of War and After. And we're talking with Ruel and also one of his patients, which if you were listening earlier on, we were talking with Jim Dillian, who had stepped on a mine, unfortunately, or a booby trap. And I got two quick announcements to make before we can get back into that interview, which I think is, to me, it's really interesting and fascinating. I did want to remind everybody that we just got an email sent to me reminding me to tell you that the VA hospital anywhere across the country, or now the VA itself, is offering free emergency care to veterans that are in a suicidal crisis. This is really important news, and I think it's really valuable for our audience to understand this. So if you are a veteran or you know of a veteran who's in a suicidal situation, they don't have to go to the VA. They can go to any emergency room anywhere in the country and the VA will pay for it. They might have to get reimbursed, but the VA will pay for it. So if you know anybody in that situation, make sure that you let people know that this is something that is available to them. I really want to make sure that they do that. We're going to talk more about this new change at the VA and a number of other things going on at the VA health and disability claims and so forth next week on our benefits program. So I just wanted to make sure this little announcement got out today. I thought it was really important. The other thing is that you just heard a Medal of Honor segment that we do every week here on Veterans Radio. And if you'd like to sponsor that, you can. You can dedicate it to a person. You can dedicate it to a unit, dad, whoever it might be. So you can just go to our Veterans Radio website and check it out. You'll find it on there. It's called A Salute to Service. I think that's what it's called one of these days. Yeah, Salute and Honor. That's a program for you. And you could sponsor the Medal of Honor segment. So anyway, sorry for the diversion. Let me get back here to Ruel Long, who was in Vietnam in 1970, 71. So Ruel, you got pretty busy there in July at the MASH unit, didn't you?
Yes, we did. The interesting thing that was going on when Jim got there, you know, Bob Hope was up at Da Nang with his USO show, and just before he arrived, there were some of the people who had been in country the longest at our unit got permission to convoy up there to see the show. So it left us with reduced number of personnel. And so, but Jim was fortunate with the surgeon that I was with, the team that greeted him and took care of him when he arrived. The surgeon's nickname was the Rabbit, and that guy had the fastest, most efficient pair of hands, surgical hands, I have ever seen, and that includes my entire career. I've never seen anybody that could operate like him. And he was Jim's surgeon. When Jim got there, there was the nurses and the Rabbit and me there to take care of him and stuff and get him stable and ready for surgery. The Rabbit, by the way, is still alive. Some of us are gone that were there then, but sure. The Rabbit is still alive. He became a plastic surgeon after Vietnam, and as actually, when I talked to him a year or two ago, he had made 3 trips back to Vietnam to operate on kids. But he's retired, of course. But talked to him a few months ago. He was in good health then. After that initial thing, it was busy the whole time I was there. The busiest time we had, though, was in late March, around the 27th, when we had the Firebase Marianne attack, which was the deadliest attack on any firebase throughout the entire war. And I had been bouncing back between the operating room doing anesthesia and triage, I think they lost track of how long I'd been awake, and I pulled a couple of real long shifts day and night in surgery, and then got assigned the triage thing, and I'd been about three days with almost no sleep, and somebody finally realized I was getting pretty tired, and they told me, they said, go to your room, there's a D-Rose party, some guy going home, and they call it a D-Rose party, date of estimated return from overseas party. Anyway, the pharmacist had the job of spiking the punch bowl, and I was anybody that used alcohol, so they said, go get a good drink out of that, that'll help you unwind, and hit the sack, you can sleep all night. So I did what they told me to, and not being anybody used to alcohol, one drink out of that thing pretty well had me dizzy. So I went and hit the sack, and then as it turns out, I fell asleep right away, but I was only asleep for about 10 minutes, as it turns out. And George, the chaplain, was shaking me, waking me up. And he says, come on, Long, you got to get up. And I said, yeah, go away, George. They said I could sleep all night. Go away. I've been slept for days. And he said, you've got to get up. I said, leave me alone, George. And finally, I heard the word Mascal. He said, we've got a Mascal on our hands. They need you. They're going to need you in surgery. And I sat up, and I sat up on the side of the bed and looked at George. And I said, George, I'm dizzy. I might be drunk. He said, no. He says, no. He says, you'll be fine. He says, wash your face. I'll get you some coffee. You can go do triage till we open the fourth stall. The fourth operating stall. So I stood up, washed my face, and slugged some coffee, and I got my clothes on and headed over to triage. And walking in there in triage in a situation like that, if there was any alcohol effect, it's gone right away, because the chaos in there changes everything. I mean, just the smell of the place, the evaporating blood and everything, and the place packed with casualties. And so I started making sure we had good line ID lines and people, and sort helping the surgeons. Every surgeon was there, and they're sorting through trying to figure out who needed to go to surgery first. And, you know, if you needed to go right away, it was called ASAP. If it needed to go instantly, it was ASAP. So anyway, they got it sorted out right away, and I wasn't in triage too long before they were ready to open our fourth operating stall. And so I went over there and ran that for we went day and night there for a while till we got through all the casualties. And at the end of it, I was just 28, but my feet were kind of swollen and spongy, and I actually had pinning edema of down in my legs, I could push in like somebody in heart failure, and the imprint would stay right here. And so, as it turns out, at one point there, I think they started directing the helicopters elsewhere to let us recover, because I went to sleep at one point and actually woke up because I was hungry, and I realized I had slept for 24 straight hours.
I only woke up because
I was hungry, and I ate a can of Vienna sausages. The wife would send me stuff like that from home, and went back and slept for a few more hours.
So Moscow is mass casualties, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that was, yep. I got a little text there. What does that mean? So I think that's important to understand that the doctors, you know, Rule, one of the things that, and Jim, you know, one of the things that I've learned in doing this program over the years is that, you know, we've come to really respect what the other people did in the other branches, because we really didn't have a clue of what you guys were doing. And, you know, I'm just flying around in the sky, picking up people and stuff, but I didn't know what happened when they got back on the ground or what they were doing before I got there. And I just have to admire you, you know, for the work that you were doing. I mean, there are many, many people that are still alive today because of the work that you and the other doctors and nurses did. And that gives me my segue over to Jim DeLynn to talk about what he remembers of that day after, you know, he got put on that operating table. Jim, can you tell us what you remember? Jim, are you still there?
Can you hear me?
Yep, now I can. Okay. So I was just going to, if it's okay, do you remember what happened that day after you got into the MASH unit?
Oh, yes, I do. They kept asking me questions to keep me awake and alert, and I was getting tired of that because I just wanted to get some pain pills or something, a shot for pain. And they said, well, you already had that. You've got those marks on your forehead, and but it wasn't doing much for it. And when Rule came up, his voice was pretty calming. I wanted to be knocked out. I wanted to get in the operating room, let them do what they needed to do. And in the book, I knew that my legs were gone. I took a peek, and but I asked Rule about to take my legs, you know, save my legs, and he said, "We'll do the best we can," and that was good enough for me, and that helped calm me down a bit, and we went ahead. He did his magic and put me to sleep. And then I woke up in the intensive care unit after that.
How long did you stay in Vietnam before you were sent to Japan, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I was there for 7 days. And then they shipped me. Well, by that time, I recovered enough that I could travel. So.
Okay, and then where did you do your recuperation here in the States?
I ended up at Valley Forge Army Hospital in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Conveniently located for you, right?
Well, it was the military will send you to the hospital closest to your home or record. So that was it, especially with the specialty and with amputees and plastic surgery and a number of other specialties that they took care of that Valley Forge.
Well, obviously, and I encourage people to read this book. It's just a great story about two men. MASH Doctor in Vietnam by Rule Long, MD. Rule is spelled R-E-U-E-L, S Long. You can get it. I think you can get it on Amazon and so forth, can't you, Rule?
Out there, it's on Amazon and I think Barnes & Noble. Target. I've seen it all over the place.
Oh, really? Okay.
And, yeah.
And probably if you want to get an autograph copied, let me know and I'll make sure that, you know, I'll get in touch with Rule and get you one of those.
Sure enough.
You know, we're laughing a little bit about this, but it's an amazing recovery, I think. And Jim, if you could just kind of give our audience a little idea of what your life was like after that occurred and after you got out of Valley Forge, how did things work out for you?
Well, there was a little bit of wandering at first, and I'll admit I jumped in a bottle for a while. I drank a lot of alcohol in the period to, I guess, use as a crutch, so to speak. And but I did have a little bit of wanderlust, and went to Spain with a friend of mine who was in the Air Force, and he got stationed near Madrid at Torrejon Air Force Base. So I went over to Spain, and not too long after that, my girlfriend, who is now my wife, my bride of 47 years, she came over, and we went down to the little island of Samos in Greece, and we lived there for a while. And then when we came back to the States, I had a Volkswagen van, Volkswagen camper, and we traveled for 2 years around the country.
Oh, that's great. But then you used your GI Bill.
Well, not quite yet. I wanted to fly, so we were in Arizona, and there's a group called the Arizona Wheelchair Pilots Association. I went to one of their meetings and saw that, this is a doable thing. Hand control in an airplane, something that I was very interested in. So my wife and I, Carol and I, we ended up in Richmond, Virginia, where they had a flight school utilizing a hand control and Piper Cherokees in order to do flight training. So at that time, I went ahead and got my pilot's license. And my life connected with aviation took off, so to speak, from there.
And you were involved in aviation throughout your career, weren't you?
Well, that's aviation.
One way or another?
Wasn't my career. I knew that if I wanted to own my own airplane, I'd have to be able to do the work on it in order to defray that expense. So I went to airframe and power plant mechanics school. This is moving back to Michigan, little AMP school in Grayling, Michigan, Kirtland Community College. And I went through that program and got my airframe and power plant license. And shortly after I graduated, I was invited in as a lab assistant in order to teach the subjects in aviation maintenance.
All right. And so you did that for a while. How long did you work in that field?
Well, altogether 24 years. I worked at Kirtland, which is, this was my on-the-job training. And I went to school on the GI Bill and got a teaching degree from Ferris State University here in Michigan. And also got a master's degree. And then I was part of the crew that started a brand new program at Northern Michigan University. So altogether, 24 years. That's a long way to get there, but 24 years teaching.
I think that's a great story. And I know Rule was telling me how proud he was of what you were able to accomplish. And, you know, that the idea of transitioning especially for wounded veterans, you know, can be a little bit more challenging than it is for the rest of us. But how proud he was of you, you know, really making something of your life after your, you know, double amputee. I just got a text from somebody that wants to congratulate you and your wife, Carol, on 47 years. And also to both of you, Jim and Rule, for your service in Vietnam. Let me go back to Rule here. We've got about 4 minutes left, maybe.
Okay.
All right, you survived all this. I mean, you know, we got to get people to buy the book. Buy the book. If there's a link to it on our website, veteransradio.net. You'll find there's a link where you can purchase it. So what, real quickly, what did you do when you finally got out of the service?
Well, I was fortunate enough to survive my closest call over there in Pleiku. You know, I should tell you that it was one point when the rockets were dropping between our Quonset huts when I was just praying to be alive for five more minutes. And I've been quite blessed because the good Lord gave me that 5 minutes at 52 more years. So anyway, after I got out of the service, I went back to Michigan for the residency, and I worked in Flint for a while. I worked over at Chelsea Hospital for a while. I worked down in Toledo for a while. I actually got to my son, who turned 3 years old while I was in Vietnam. He ended up in anesthesia, and for a while after he finished his training at the Mayo Clinic, he came and worked in private practice just for a couple of years down in Toledo. And I got to work with him for a couple of years, and it was so much fun. But he got recruited back to where he belonged at the Mayo Clinic, and he's out there now, and he's the program director for the anesthesiology residency program at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And so he's out there, and I'm retired on the farm taking care of the pond and watching the grandkids and hoping to be around to see some great-grandkids. So we're out here in the same place that I lived in when I was a resident, just northwest of Ann Arbor, on 30 acres out here, where it's nice and quiet, and I still have to look up every time I see the University or St. Joe helicopter go over. I can't, you know, the helicopter blades always get my attention still. And so we're out here enjoying our retirement, and we've been married. We were high school sweethearts, got married after I finished junior college, and we got married in 1963. So it's, 1962, I'm sorry.
And
I better get it right. Yeah. So it's been quite a few years now. By the way, one thing I should tell you that I got a kick out of Jim when I asked him when we reconnected, I said, did you have any trouble with alcohol? I got such a kick out of his answer. He said, no, I didn't have a bit of trouble with alcohol. There was a lot available. I drank all I could get. And so I thought, well, okay. But when I asked him what straightened him out, he gave credit to that woman he married, and she's a wonderful gal.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of us went through taste testing a lot, put it that way.
Yeah.
For a while, until we came to the realization that this, you know, wasn't doing us any good, and, you know, we needed to get a hold of what's really important. I wish we had more time. There's so many more little interesting anecdotes that you throw in your book, not only about your service in Vietnam and your temporary duties and some of the adventures that you had there. And the same with Jim's little biography is in there as well. So I would encourage people, as I say, to get this book. It's really a good, easy read. And you're going to learn a lot about the time. There's a lot of social things that were occurring while everybody was in Vietnam that, you know, most of us weren't even aware of until we got home, and suddenly things changed all over the place. You know, the name of the book again is MASH Doctor in Vietnam, A Memoir of War and After. The author is Ruel Long, and Ruel is spelled R-E-U-E-L M-D. And it's a good story. He's got pictures of both of Ruel and Jim on the cover, and it looks like somewhere in, I think that is that Pleiku by chance on the cover?
No, the picture that they put on the cover, that's a shot at the site at the beach there where the 95th evac is at the base of Monkey Mountain. That's where they sent me after we closed the surge on the 16th of May. I went up there next, and that's a shot of the, you can see the little fishing boats out there in the off the shore there, and that's the base of Monkey Mountain in the background there.
I never got that far north.
Okay.
Monkey Mountain. All right. No, I was in Three Corps the whole time I was over there, but we did have that. I think you mentioned it before. I think it was the 24th evac hospital there in Long Bend.
And, Long Bend. Yeah. They'd bring you in there, and they would let you get used to the weather and the equipment and stuff there before they sent you out.
Well, I wanted to thank you very much, Rule, I for the book and also for knowing you, and the idea of putting this whole thing together, I think, is great for our audiences to understand a little bit more about what happened to, you know, not only to the infantry guys on the ground or the helicopter pilots through me, but also the docs and the nurses and everybody else that was involved over there. It was quite the adventure for all of us. It was a little bit scary too, but you know, and we remember this all the time. So anyway, I want to thank both of you for being on the program. It's been a privilege to talk to both you and Jim on Veterans Radio today. And I appreciate you taking the time and talking to us. And I hope that we can get together at some time, maybe at the bakery, and reconnect.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jim, very much. All right, that's our program for the day. We will be back next week with our benefits program. And so if you have any questions to ask to our experts, make sure you send them to me by my email. That's dale@veteransradio.net. And we will talk about those next week on Veterans Radio. The name of the book, again, is MASH Doctor in Vietnam. You can find it on our website, find it on our Facebook page. And to the rest of you, have a great upcoming week. And until next week, this is Dale Thronberry for Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.